Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, it's my terrific honor to be talking to John Ashbery. We're here in New York City. The occasion is the publication of his new book, Planisphere. It's published by Echo. John Ashbery is, of course, the author of many books of poetry. The first volume of his collected poems recently came out from Library of America. Those are the poems from 1956 to 1987. Notes from the Air, which is a collection of his selected later poems. John is one of my favorite guests because it's easy to say he's one of my two or three very favorite living poets. To me, John Ashbery has been an education in every way in what poetry can do. First of all, John, what is a planisphere?
It's a flat rendering of a hemisphere shape, such as a map of the globe, which one half of our terrestrial globe, for instance. It's mentioned in a poem by Andrew Marvel, which I've always kind of, it's always been part of my consciousness. It's something about our love shall be compressed into a planisphere. I don't remember what the rest of it is, but a poem is really a flat rendering of feelings or experiences. I mean, that might be one reason for justifying it. I also just like the sound of the word.
When words appear in your poems and reappear, I noticed, for instance, in this book, one poem mentions sticker shock, and then a later one has sticker shock as a title. These repetitions that occur, are they accidental or just luck of the draw?
That one was. I didn't realize, in fact, that there had been a repetition. But contemporary jargon is very much constantly shifting around in my brain, and words like sticker shock and aha moment, which also appears in one of the poems, get used along with more highfalutin words like planisphere.
I wanted, first of all, to hear the poem Episode, the first of two poems called Episode.
Yes, there are two called Episode, and that actually was not accidental. I mean, I knew that there were two. I liked not calling them Episode 1 and Episode 2. Episode. In old days, when they tried to figure out how to write the sweetest melodies, they fell on a bed, chewed the pillow. A moon rankled in the crevices of a shutter. In 1935, the skirts were long and flared slightly, suitably. Hats shaded part of the face. Lipstick was fudgy and encouraging. There was music in the names of the years. 1937 was welcoming, too, though one bit one's lip, preparing for the pain that was sure to come. That must be awful. I was hoping you could imagine it. Yet I will be articulate again, and articulate what we knew anyway of what the lurching moon had taught us, seeking music where there's something dumb being said. And if it comes back to being all alone at the starting gate, so be it. We hadn't wanted this fuss, these extras. We were calm under an appearance of turmoil, and so we remain even today, an unwanted inspiration to those who come immediately after, as well as those who came before, lots of them, stretching back into times of discussion. I told you we can handle it. Hand on the stick shift, headed into a billboard labeled tomorrow, the adventures of new music, melismas shrouding the past and the passing days.
John Ashbery, reading episode. In the poem, you mention being an unwanted inspiration to those who come immediately after, as well as to those who came before. And I was wondering, you know, the Publishers Weekly commented, I think perceptively, that they thought that you had now come to the point of being influenced by younger poets whom you've influenced. Do you think that's the case?
Oh, yes, definitely. I read the work of young poets a great deal. And since I have been a teacher, or was for a number of years, I obviously had to since I was teaching poetry writing courses. And I've always tried to avoid the cliché, I learned from my students, which a lot of professors use. But it's true in my case. I learned from some of them anyway. And often find that the work of young poets who have absorbed my work and were influenced by it and then threw it off wanting to break away and write something new. And that, of course, influences me all over again. And I can make the same effort to break away from myself once I've read them.
I was talking to Howard Stokar, Charles Warren's partner,
mm-hmm.
and he quoted you as saying something that fascinated me. And I don't necessarily want to know what you meant, but what you might have meant. He said that you said that language sometimes gets in the way of the poetry.
I don't remember saying that, and I can't really imagine what I meant, although it's a fascinating statement, and I intend to ponder it and find out what it was I may have meant if I said it.
You see, it would be fairly easy for me to imagine you or any number of other poets saying that the meaning sometimes gets in the way of the poetry, but the language getting away in the way of the poetry seemed a new realm to me and kind of exciting.
Yeah, I suppose once we've got rid of meaning, then it's time to start getting rid of language. Why I am interested in such things is a different question, but which I, at the moment, can't think of an answer to. But I suppose that it's new kinds of poetry are always exciting if they kind of open up new areas in that sense.
I've often thought when reading you that there's a quality of language, well, like language when a child discovers it before it becomes useful.
Yeah.
When it can be something that's played with,
yeah,
and put down, and parents might clap their hands,
yes,
out of delight about what a child has said but not meant.
Yeah.
And I think that poetry and your poetry does that on occasion. And the sense of equipment being there, games and toys. But I remember,
yeah,
that there were all sorts of things I played with as a child that were, you know, abettors or tools for making language, like rebus games and things like that, that were more fun when they retained their mystery, their possibility.
Yeah.
And I suddenly thought, well, no critic wants to talk about this, but the idea of language before it has gotten serious and useful seems to me to be a poet's language.
Yeah. I suddenly remembered, I'm pretty sure it's a passage from Kafka's diaries where he describes being very young, maybe 2 years old, and hearing what he thinks is someone, perhaps his mother, saying, "I am reveling in the grass." I think I'm remembering that correctly. And at the same time, that made me remember an early memory of being in a school where I went to kindergarten and coming to the top of a stairs and saying, "I regret these stairs." Of course, I didn't know what regret meant, but it seemed very profound. And in fact, I think it was. I did regret those stairs.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with poet John Ashbery about his new book of poems, Planisphere. Let's hear another poem. I'm kind of crazy about the one called Upstate Dancers.
Oh, okay. Upstate Dancers. The plants grow in proscribed wonder at having accomplished this feat, at least this far. Ivy, calceolaria, don't have that much to think about. Any and all distractions welcome. As one would spear a fish, the next layer becomes rudely evident. All of us here, including me out, are eager to know your plans and to help in any way we could. Sometimes a stench decides everything. We're all better at some things. It doesn't matter that your soles have patches, that your big toe wiggles appreciatively. Some of us are going to mind more than others. Upstate dancers don't dance much anymore. The trolley line sped through shucks an empire ago. Fishing lures were coated with a sandy surface. Makes them more attractive, I believe. So why did it happen with an echo? We thought we had taken it into account. Turns out we were wrong.
What were you thinking about when you wrote that one?
I have no idea. I usually don't, as a matter of fact.
Uh-huh. Are they, then, do you know what they are?
The poems?
Yeah.
No.
It's a pleasure, you know, to me, that you don't. But do you know then when it's completed, or when you've gotten it right, or when it's not working? What are the criteria?
Yeah, well, they're highly subjective, and I know them. I know when they don't work, and when I don't want to use them, when I want to reject or recycle. But I really don't recycle very much. I'd rather start over from zero. But I don't know what kind of mechanism clicks off or on when I feel I've finished a poem, and that's enough for me.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with John Ashbery, author most recently of a new book of poems, Planisphere, published by Echo. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with John Ashbery about his new book of poems, Planisphere. We've been discussing the mysterious and playful use of language in his work. Planisphere immediately, even before you know what it means, suggests a metaphysical poem. The finding of the exact phrase and that sense of the beautiful in the arcane combining with the typical and culture-worn seems like, you know, yes, everyone will say, well, that's what Ashbery does. But it seems that here in Planisphere, it's almost effortless. Let's hear Planisphere.
Okay, this is Planisphere. Mysterious barricades. Maybe I should footnote that, you know, the...
Tell me.
It's a harpsichord work by Couperin, a 18th century French composer, Les Barricades Mystérieuses. And there's always been a great deal of speculation as to what exactly that means. Could it mean perhaps a young woman's maidenhead that's been one
mysterious barricade
offered? If that's unfamiliar to you, it won't be certainly to. It will be unfamiliar to many people, and it's always hard to know how rarefied one's illusions ought to be before one reins them in. On the other hand, I don't think it really makes very much difference. You could read that and not know what it referred to and still take account of it in the poem, I guess. Mysterious barricades, a headrest of sorts, boarded the train at Shinjuku Junction.
What is Shinjuku Junction?
That is in a subway stop in Tokyo, I believe. I actually didn't check it, but I think it's. I was in Tokyo a couple of times, and I think I passed through there. To the palpable consternation of certain other rubberneckers, already installed in the observation car of their dreams. It's so peaceful on my pallet. I could just live here. In a second, the deadbeat returned with lunch tokens. It had been meant to be sublime, but hell was what it more specifically resembled. Remember to hold the course and take two of everything. That way, if we make journey's end before the tracks expire, we'll have been found living in it. The deep magenta sunset, I mean. There is nothing like putting off a journey until the next convenient interruption, swamps, onlookers, and ticket holders alike. We all more or less resembled one another until that fatal day in 1861, when the walkways fell off the mountains and the spruces spruced down. I mean, it was unimaginable in a way. You'll have to install a park with chairs and restrooms for the weary and a simple but firm visitor's code for it to be given out in your name and become a boon to limp multitudes who thought you were somebody else or didn't know what it was you did. But we'll stay clean, by God, and when the tide of misinformation reaches the first terrace, we'll know what to do, yell our heads off, and admit to no mistakes. The land stretched away like jelly into a confused cleft. All was yapping, the race having ended before we arrived, with mixed results. Nobody knew what they owed or how much credit had been advanced, being incapable of niceties like buzzing and herding fleas till the next shipment of analgesics arrived. It was like forming signals out of loam when you were young and too discouraged to care very much about aftershocks or where the dye ended up. It was too smoky in the little kitchen garden or potager to pay much mind to the rabbits and their plankton dispensary. Something had been launched, we knew that.
John Ashbery, reading Planisphere. Now, you'll allow me to fell over the plankton dispensary. There are certain phrases that appear in this book. Jelly is mentioned several times, but my favorite is the jelly farm. Someone told me that Knott's Berry Farm and Smucker's were both jelly farms, but it doesn't matter to me. Somehow or other, there's a... tell me how things like that come to you. I mean, spontaneously, do you have them before the poem? Are you, you know, can you do that for me?
Well, mostly they occur to me while I'm writing. I maybe we'll start off with a few phrases or images in mind and proceed to write from them to see where it takes me. And in the course of doing that, other things will happen. And like the plankton dispensary, which I sort of apologize for that because everybody knows that rabbits don't eat plankton, so why would they want a plankton dispensary? But on the other hand, it just seemed right, and I wasn't going to do anything about it. I was going to leave it in place. I guess I have reached a point where there are things in my work that I can't defend, but I'm not going to worry too much about.
Well, but that's what seems to me to be so wonderful. At first, I didn't know what to do with your poems at all, except to reread them. They were so mystifying to me. And I reread them for years without understanding that I already understood them, or that whatever understanding by and large was required had been internalized, you know, that I now took pleasure in these sentences and lines of poetry, the like of which I couldn't find anywhere else. And then I grew to love and look forward to them as a favorite thing, almost like something giving me the delight that certain toys did, but there were no longer toys like that. And so for me, although the poems are not trying to do anything, force any recognitions, they're somewhat diffident often, they nevertheless seem to me to be therefore still more amusing and more delightful. I guess, you know, I've grown up with you and been there while poetry, to the extent that it's changed, has changed because of these things. This is turning into a very long sentence tribute to seemingly know of someone who never took orders, who did it, what did they say, I did it my way, but who never had the felt obligation to surrender to anything but one's own strange impulse. It seems marvelous and exemplary to me.
Thank you. That's wonderful. I always hoped that what I was writing would connect with a reader, but it took a long time for that to happen. When I first began reading modern poetry, I thought, "Oh, this is wonderful! It's so strange and hard to read. I'd like to write that way myself. I'm pretty strange. I'll just put it in poetry, and people will like it." And then, after it was published, I realized that it was really too strange, that I had somehow gone beyond the pale, and for a number of years, really, I didn't have much of an audience, and people thought I was being willfully obscure, and which is not really what I was intending. But at the same time, I guess I didn't want to take the steps to be totally unobscure either. So I kept on even during periods when I thought I would maybe stop writing poetry, since it was just annoying people, and I should maybe find some other means of expression, like needlepoint or something. But and then after that, it dawned on me that this is what I like to do, so I was going to do it. And if nobody else liked it, well, that's too bad. But I didn't mean for that to be. But my own pleasure was what I should be thinking about at this point. And so eventually it seems to have connected with people such as yourself.
Let's end with a short poem. I'm very fond of Zero Percentage.
Oh. Zero Percentage. So call it untitled, but don't imagine you'll be let off the hook. The title will find it, as surely as a heat-seeking missile locks on an asteroid. Down below, armies and oceans of taxis will squawk unfeelingly. The title always wins.
Now, can I ask you, because it is a play on winning the title.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Undoubtedly, I meant that, but I don't remember it.
Thank you, John Ashbery.
Oh, thank
it's a
you,
pleasure
Michael.
For me
always
to talk
a pleasure.
To you. John Ashbery has been my guest today on Bookworm. He is the author, most recently, of a new book of poems, Planisphere, published by Echo. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to recording engineer Leszek Wojciech at the Carnegie Studios in New York City. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books. Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm, plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.